Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hi, you're listening to The Advice Show. This is Zachariah Sharif from NMA. I'm here with my colleague Nicola Blackburn and founder of campaigning group Reboot, Noreen Middleshaw. Noreen, how are you?
Yes, good. Thank you, Zach. Hi, Nicola.
Hello. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Noreen, so you're head of marketing communications for Numis and you also founded Reboot. Can I just ask, first of all, why Reboot was set up, why you felt the need to set it up, and how it's all going with reference to your report last year as well?
Sure. So I'm going to give you a very long-winded, but I'll try and keep it to the point as well. But Reboot, it's our second anniversary, actually. We launched 2 Januaries ago. So obviously, with the horrendous murder of George Floyd in that summer, I just think it had ramifications across the globe. So what was a very American, a black race issue, it just obviously resonated in many ways across the globe, within the workplace, and it allowed other marginalized groups to speak out. And you know, you look at the UK and it's got its own very unique dynamics with race and ethnicity, with our colonial history, etc. But I think for the first time, and I'm not going to give away my age, but in my many, many decades of living, I just noticed there was a very a different view in terms of how people spoke about race. All of a sudden, it really shifted, and it was definitely a bit of a milestone moment. And it's something I've always observed as a British Pakistani growing up in a very white area, and not that that's good or bad. It was just, you know, like observations I've always had. And having a communications background, I just decided to write a few blogs about, you know, things that impacted my family growing up. And, you know, very quickly I realized the power of storytelling and how people resonated with the stories, and they were able to relate to them because I shared something that, you know, other ethnic minorities said, oh, that happened to my family, etc. And, you know, it actually sparked a very healthy debate, mostly within, you know, my LinkedIn network is mostly financial services professionals, it really got me thinking, in terms of the role that I do, you know, we're the bridge between these companies and these great journalists who then provide a platform to share these stories. So, you know, what else can we do just to ensure that this momentum stays? And that's kind of how Reboot was born. So it started off with lots of communication professionals, that give up their time across the industry. We work with lots of senior ethnic minorities of lots of different job roles, mostly within financial services. And, you know, we want to really showcase them as role models for the next generation coming in, but also to raise awareness. And we'll talk about this later, but, you know, there is this discomfort still about talking about race in the UK. So we're trying to normalize the conversation. And then more importantly, with all these insights and stories, etc., you know, that we're collecting, you know, we want to make sure that there's going to be long lasting, sustainable change. So we are hoping to have some more sort of regulatory or some sort of reform at a policy level as well. So we can have something really impactful that comes out of it as well. So that, I hope that kind of explains, that's Reboot.
Definitely.
Can I ask
on that, Noreen, because obviously your experience and background is in financial services. So I was wondering, when you took the kind of writing that you were doing on this topic and launched Reboot and kind of focused in on financial services and this issue in financial services, was that because you saw in particular it was a sector that could be looking at this issue more? Or do you think it was just, you know, a way of marrying something that you were really passionate about with, you know, the sector that you were in and you wanted to kind of do work in that sector?
Yeah, definitely the latter. But and I suppose my original blog was actually based more on my dad when he came to this country. So it was regarding a FTSE 100 company, so not within financial services. I would love to do all workplaces, you know, but you can't boil the ocean. And I just think within financial services, we know the industry, we know the media landscape a lot better. So we thought, actually, if we're going to create impact, let's let's just start off here and see where we can go. But it is, I mean, it's great that it is financial services just because we have that dual hat within our industry. So yes, it's, you know, one of the largest industries within UK, but it's also, it has the fiduciary responsibilities as well. So you've got your double hat there. So they are also investing on behalf of, you know, millions of everyday people. So they also have that, that sort of that asset stewardship, that sustainability, that role as well. So in a way, it was quite lucky that we went to financial services, because I feel like it can have a, it can cascade further than financial services as well. But we need to get our house in order first.
Absolutely. And on that subject, you know, you spoke about how, you know, in the wake of the events of sort of the last couple of years, that progress has, well, momentum was your word, which was quite a good word to use, has started and kept going. And that applies to financial services as well. I'm quite interested, just because I entered this profession only a year ago, so I wasn't aware of what the progress was like beforehand. And I just want to ask, how much do you think has been made sort of since that, since a year, about a year ago? And how much do you think there's still more to do?
Yeah, so I think if we were going to be really honest, I mean, we've the financial services industry has been talking about diversity for a long time. I suppose the focus has been more on gender diversity. And that kind of makes sense because, you know, females, they make up 50% of the population. And there was definitely a huge disparity and there really is now as well. I think what the BLM movement did is it put a spotlight on race and ethnicity. So yes, there's been things happening about it, but it was not often forgotten, but it definitely wasn't high on the agenda like it is now. So I think over the last couple of years, we've definitely noticed there's a lot more noise around it. There's a lot more training around it within organizations. There's a lot more awareness around it. So we're definitely seeing positive impact. But I think, you know, the Race to Equality UK Financial Services report, this is the second year. I think what we're finding is whilst there's a lot more happening, there's no tangible impact on the back of it. So the issues still remain the same. So yes, it's great that we're talking about it and it's great companies are doing a lot more. You know, there's still a long way to go, but however, we're looking at there's still a lack of, you know, senior ethnic minorities in those positions. And it makes it harder for others to get into the industry because, you know, naturally as humans, you want to see someone that looks like you or you can relate to. If I can see it, I can be it. And, you know, and that's actually stopping a lot of progression for ethnic minorities. And you know, they're saying that they need more role models. They need to see more people in senior positions so they know they can make those roles. So, you know, that's still an issue. But the other thing that's an issue is data. So I can't tell you, you know, specific data. I can give you indicative. I can, you know, I can tell you what these findings are saying. But because there's no real way of capturing that information yet, you know, it's hard for me to give you a proper lay of the land on what's going on. And until we really know, it's hard to come up with a really specific plan to try and, you know, remedy what those issues are. So that's kind of where we are at the moment.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that lack of data point is really important. And I think if we're, you know, if we're referencing the progress that, and even then it's extremely limited progress that the industry has made in terms of a gender diversity balance, because even then the lack of women in senior roles is pretty outstanding still. And CityWire has done quite a bit of work referencing that in our alpha female surveys. But sorry, even comparing with that relative, with that change of gender diversity, you're right, it is different. There is a lack of data. There's no sort of granularity going on over, you know, how many people of British Pakistani descent are in financial services, how many, and you can't then break that down by section, I suppose. Do you think a lot of this stems from what you were talking about before about an uncomfortability talking about race? That perhaps isn't there with gender diversity?
Yeah, there's definite discomfort. And I've got to say, we've got to kind of move on and get a little bit under the bonnet around the conversation. So, you know, we're all familiar with the term BAME, but that's kind of been now discontinued, so to speak, by the government. So it had its purpose. It's, you know, it did what it had to do, but it was just too broad brush because, you know, you're talking about so many groups of people under, you know, these four headings. And, you know, to give you an example, you know, you've got the Asian group, which is 8% of the UK population, and that is so diverse within that. So you cannot lump so many people within that. So I obviously look at it, you know, coming from a British Pakistani angle, I very seldom see British Pakistani senior, you know, figureheads. So when I do, I take notice to it. But people will look at me, they will just see a brown face, and then they think, oh, but you're doing well. You know, but we've noticed it's our black peers that aren't doing so well. But then you speak to your black peers and actually they're saying, well, there's, you know, the experiences between someone of black West African origin versus black Caribbean is very different. And then thank God for the ONS data, because, you know, you can get some sort of idea of what's going on there. But you see it's the black Caribbean women, the British Pakistani women and the British Bangladeshi women that are the lowest paid and the most underrepresented. So I think people need to not only get comfortable with it, they need to really understand the nuances of what's happening in the UK. And that's why that granularity is really important. And that's why, you know, you look at the gender pay gap reporting that's been so, well, successful. It's definitely made a difference. You know, we would like to apply that to ethnicity pay gap reporting, but get that granular information so we can really understand how different groups are faring within financial services and, you know, and really help create a roadmap on how we can make those improvements.
Mm-hmm. Noreen, in your opinion, when you were doing the research, compiling this year's report, did you find that, you know, the majority of the barriers, I suppose, came at the stage of recruitment and getting, you know, these groups into the workplace in financial services in the first place? Or was it more when they were there, there were issues within the workplace? What did you find?
Yeah, so I think what we're now hearing is, you know, at an entry level, it's become less of an issue because I think a lot of companies are creating that diversity at an entry level. But I'd be very surprised if nothing happened before this. So I'm pretty sure it always happened, but there's definitely more onus on it. But I suppose it's, you know, you need to look at the complete picture. So whilst it's great all these new entry level people are coming into the industry, I hope people won't assume, oh, in 20 years it won't be an issue because now we fixed it. But that's not it, because who is making sure that we retain this talent? Who is making sure, you know, they will also get a fair share of, you know, what their white peers are getting in terms of opportunities, et cetera. And, you know, who will make sure they're not going to have those glass ceilings, et cetera. And at the moment, we're still seeing all these issues, which are, you know, which are obstacles in terms of, you know, ethnic minorities reaching their potential. So if these barriers are still there, there's no good in having all these great entry-level talent coming in, because what will happen is, and what the report is saying is, they're just thinking of leaving. Some are thinking about leaving job because they're not getting what they want out of their career, but some might just leave the industry altogether, and we don't really capture that data. You know, and it's really interesting because a few people I have spoken to that left financial services, they don't say why specifically, because it's subconsciously there, but you just have to ask them a few questions and they end up saying, it just wasn't for me, I didn't fit in, oh, you know, I didn't go drinking, or I didn't play golf, you know, and I wasn't getting anywhere, so I went off and I set up a business. So they're not saying it wasn't inclusive, because they probably don't even realize it themselves. They're just leaving though, because they just don't feel like they fit in or that they'll make it. And, you know, and that's very telling.
Definitely, yeah. As something I found really interesting that the report picked out was that even though we're seeing, I think it was like more and more financial services firms implementing diversity, equity, and inclusion training, you're also seeing a rise in people feeling, you know, not supported in their workplace. So I wonder if that pointed to kind of some of the things that you were bringing up about, you know, maybe just thinking about how this was actually helping people and sort of, you know, the outcomes that it was producing in terms of making people feel more included and, you know, understood, I suppose.
Yeah, and I hope this report isn't all doom and gloom, because as per your point, I think ethnic minorities, although survey respondents have definitely noticed, there's been an uptick of different D&I initiatives within the organisation over the last couple of years. So that's great. And I think, but I suppose where the issues then stem from is they feel like they're not being spoken to. So the initiatives that come across, I think, you know, that they're created in, I would say, isolation, or employees aren't really considered, or, you know, they discuss it with them. Because if you find, you know, if you hear what the actual initiatives companies are doing versus what employees actually want to see, there is a little bit of a discrepancy. So, you know, there definitely is maybe a lack of communication between the leadership and their employees. And also, yes, there's lots more going on, but I think there's still a leaning more towards supporting gender diversity versus ethnicity. And I think that just goes back to that discomfort, you know, to talk about it. And I think we, you know, discussed in a previous call, but, it, you know, in terms of that discomfort, I think what it also comes down to is, yes, women make 50% of the population, but you look at, you know, who holds those senior roles. And, you know, I don't think I'd be offending anyone if I said it's normally a white middle-class male, you know, so they are likely to have a female in their life as their wife, their partner, their daughter, their mum, their sisters. So actually gender diversity is something that they can get behind. They relate to it because they have that at home in their personal lives as well. But, you know, then you've got 14% of the population, which is an ethnic minority. But what are the chances that they have something similar in their lives, like in their social circle, in their friends, etc.? Mm. So for many, it could therefore become a little bit uncomfortable to talk about race because they're not familiar with it. And unfortunately, that does then, you know, come into the workplace and they're equally as uncomfortable to talk about it. So you know, but they don't realize indifference is actually, you know, it's bad news now because we need allies, we need people to support us, and we need people to, you know, be very proactive about showing that they're supportive of, you know, supporting their ethnic minority colleagues.
Absolutely. And I think that there can also be a danger of
it's okay.
Yeah, no worries. I haven't got five. It's fine. Well, I only said one
word.
Who's that?
Ahead of you guys.
Yeah, I was head of multimedia.
You love Alan.
Could have come and joined.
Yeah.
Great to see Alan.
Special guest.
Yeah. What was I saying? Oh, yeah.
Thank God you remember.
okay. So, yeah, I was just thinking as well about the danger of sort of diversity and inclusion training feeling quite sporadic, and that disconnect revealing itself between what employees want, what I think minority employees want, and what the employees are actually giving. And I wonder if it stems from that, if it stems from the lack, the sort of uncomfortable nature of talking about race, and the fact that people might not have diverse friends and therefore don't have that understanding. Which is obviously fine, but that understanding then needs to be educated. And I wonder if it all stems from that, because, you know, it can be perfectly well-meaning to have a series of webinars or PowerPoints or however companies decide to do it, just for educational purposes. But I think viewing it in that framework can sometimes feel quite sporadic. I wonder if that's what you feel is behind possibly a lack of a sustained policy going forward.
Yeah, and I definitely think more consideration and sort of research needs to go into that element, because you'll notice some people say, oh, I am comfortable talking about race, and then they're really not. Like, so I think what we got, you know, what we figured out is they want to be allies, they want to be comfortable about it, but there is something stopping them. So I just think there's just so much more research and understanding that needs to go into that element before we can really figure out how do we fix this. But it's almost becoming a hurdle, like that's almost blocking us from making that real progress. And until those senior leaders, they, you know, offer that tone from that top, you know, where they make it okay to talk about race, and, you know, the rest of the employees therefore feel comfortable, we're offering a safe place and this inclusive culture, this is going to continue. You know, and like I said, well, I haven't said, sorry, but, you know, if we do talk about culture within financial services, it just really worries me that the majority of people that responded, the ethnic minorities in the survey, 82%, I believe, they, you know, they said they still have, they've had unwelcome remarks about their background this year alone. And half of them actually did address it with HR. And, you know, then when they got to HR, they felt that it wasn't dealt with properly. And in fact, not only was it not dealt with properly, some felt like they were looked at differently once they did it, and that their manager treated them differently, and in future they won't be going back to HR for it. And some had to take mental health leave, you know, so that comes at a cost to the business. So So actually, you know, there not only is there a discomfort that, you know, we do need to address the culture and, you know, what practices are there in terms of, you know, so there is an actual zero tolerance to, you know, to any form of discrimination. But, you know, a quarter of the respondents said actually it's okay to say racist jokes in my company. It's not frowned upon. And, you know, and for me, that was actually quite shocking that in this day and age, you know, I think people get carried away with woke culture and whatnot. But actually, you know, you just have to look at this data and say it's not there yet. Like, there's still a long way to go.
Yeah. And you know, coming back to your point about understanding, I guess it's that thing of viewing diversity in the workplace as a topic and as a initiative and a topic, rather than something that just needs to be space standard at all times. Which is why, because I believe that was 75% of respondents in the survey felt that HR wasn't effective about dealing with the issue, which is, again, pretty shocking.
No, it really is. And, you know, and I think you've just touched on it there, you know, diversity and inclusion is sometimes seen as this fluffy thing. So the senior leaders, they're like, oh, off you go, HR or head of D&R, you sort it out. But actually, there's a huge business imperative to it as well. Like, you need to have a diverse workforce because, you know, you need to have diversity of thought. And, you know, post-Brexit, the UK, we need to, you know, be more innovative and we need to compete so much more. And we really need to be tapping into that talent so much more. So, you know, it really needs to come from the business, not just, oh, we need to tick this box. We need to have a brown face, a black face, and everything in between face. You know, it's so much more than that. And, you know, to give you an example, and it's not mine, it's the wonderful Gillian Tett in her book Anthrovision. You know, she's the editor at large for the Financial Times. And, you know, she talks about the 2008 crisis. So we had these wonderful innovative products called CDOs, you know, which a group of mostly men, you know, created. And their intentions were good. It was about de-risking. It was about creating more liquidity, you know, globally. And, you know, it had all these different instruments packaged up. And no one questioned it because it was complex. It was full of jargon. And, you know, people were too scared to challenge these really smart men. So everyone just subscribed to the fact, well, these are great because it's going to de-risk. It's going to add more liquidity to the market. And, you know, we all know what happened after that. And, you know, and but you just think, what if there was that more diversity of thought, people from looking at it from lots of different angles and, you know, ways and not feeling scared to question and to challenge, etc. Like, would it have been different? So, you know, so there is that imperative because you need to look at risk from your business perspective, but you need to look at how you're going to have more, you know, create more innovation. And it all stems down to having the right talent, but that diverse talent that's going to offer you all these different viewpoints. And, you know, this goes back to that. So yes, I'm quite passionate about the fact that it really needs to be that looked at it from a C-suite level, not just, you know, what we're seeing now to be outsourced to other parts of the business. But again, you know, some say they are, some say they're not. The jury's out on that.
Yeah. And I also, I guess it comes from, you know, the point of not seeing it as a box ticking exercise. I mean, certainly from my experience, I've also found across all industries, including financial services, that when there has been ethnic minority representation, a lot of times it can feel quite like a box ticking exercise just because class isn't considered as a factor. And I think that goes for diversity generally, including gender diversity as well, which is saying, oh, okay, that's fantastic. You've got a guy here from an Indian descent. That's fantastic. But at the end of the day, he went to the same schools that these other people went to. And I think it's not thinking about diversity in as a series of box ticking, but actually just a cultural shift and thinking, how can we include people from different backgrounds and how can we get diversity of thought? Because I think class is a factor that often gets forgotten with all these other things to consider. And the only solution to that, well, I guess one solution to that is to just think of it all as a cultural shift rather than little policies we can implement here and there.
No, and absolutely to that. There's a whole lot of intersectionality to your point. You know, there is a big class issue within the race and ethnicity, but then there's the gender point as well. And, you know, it was only a few years ago in America, there was, you know, there was this debate that gender diversity should be for all genders, not just, dare I say, white middle class women, because that's what kind of happened. And again, it goes back to who are the senior leaders, who do they relate with most? And that's quite natural. That's a very human response to it. So I think I obviously focus on race and ethnicity, but we always do it with the view that we're trying to bring it in part of this bigger puzzle, which is around lots of different types of diversity. And yes, socioeconomic comes into it, gender absolutely comes into it, but there's other things, and we're talking about neurodiversity as well. But it's really, how do you embrace all of it? And some are doing a great job, but we're very early on. I think that, the debate's only just started to happen. It's, you're looking at quite a seismic shift that has to happen to get there. But, and I think what our role is just to make sure that we're cracking that whip, we're creating that momentum so that conversation stays, and hopefully the right people are listening to us, and the right experts, etc., they're getting together, and these changes are happening, and policies are changing, etc.
Can I ask, because a lot of our listeners will be in executive senior positions at financial services firms, I think this could be of interest to them, but could you maybe pick out a couple of examples of initiatives or things that firms have done that maybe you've seen that you think have been really in tune with actually what, ethnic employees, that they have responded well to, and it's really helped kind of what they need to feel comfortable in the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, I think just having open discussions about race has actually been quite positive. So we've heard there's been instances where we've had small groups of people come together, and the C-suite will come, and they will instigate a conversation, and they will ask questions, and it will be a two-way conversation, and it's just a very open, very confidential discussion, but it's both sides trying to educate themselves and really sort of unpack or unpick those issues, and just everyone being okay about it. So they've been really useful. On a more practical level, there's one around sponsorship. So mentors are really important, but actually what's more powerful is the idea of sponsorship. So a senior ally, supports an ethnic minority, they mentor them, but they also ensure that there are no barriers to their career progression, so they're almost helping them, just to make sure that they are going, their career trajectory is where it should be. And so they support them through that journey. And, there's been a couple of instances where, we've heard that actually that has worked, and, there's been some promotions, and, this person has made it to a certain level, and had that not have been there, it definitely wouldn't have happened. So on a more practical level, I do think the idea of sponsorship is really important.
So I just wanted to ask you as well about because we're speaking about a cultural shift that sort of needs to happen, and obviously the practical result of what we've got now with the underrepresentation of ethnic minorities, and I just wonder, because obviously there's barriers to entry, but then importantly there's also barriers to ethnic minorities ascending the ladder, essentially, and I wonder how much of that you think is due to just simply a different culture and an unconscious bias, versus how much of that how much of that is down to a lack of policy or a lack of regulation or anything like that.
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I mean, I give my career as an example. It's not front office, it's communications and marketing. But, there wasn't many professionals in my family. So I just assumed I'd make it to a certain level and I wouldn't have to worry. Coming from a very traditional expanded Asian family, the women have children and then they stop working. So that's all, that's all I really saw for myself. So unless you see someone doing it, that, it's really hard for you to just say, oh, I'm just going to make it to the top, I'm going to keep going. So I think it's the lack of role models, seeing people in senior position, that is a bit of an issue. But then also having more policy and rigor, I do think probably is needed. So I know as a financial services industry, we do think regulation should be a last resort, but we've seen the positivity positives that have come out of the gender pay gap reporting. So I think on this occasion, we would just have to say, no, we just have to bring in mandatory ethnicity pay gap reporting, alongside the training that we're already seeing, the sponsorship, more mentoring. And I think once all of that comes together as that complete package, you can then start noticing that change. Mm-hmm. But like I said, at entry level, it's great. But the moment, you start wanting to climb that ladder, that's where you start, to see a lot of those issues. And we really should be looking at it holistically and just try and pinpoint where are we going wrong? How can we remedy it? So once you have all of this data, all of this insight at your fingertip, you can make a much more informed decision on how to just create a way to move forward and hopefully, bring those numbers to a more of an equal balance.
Not that this by any means should be the core reason that firms should embrace DE&I or kind of just turn their attention more towards it. But do you think there is a lack of understanding among firms about actually the financial benefits of bringing in, focusing on a having more perspectives in the workplace and the benefits that can bring to their work and therefore the financial health of their businesses?
Yeah, I think they're slowly getting there. It's slowly happening. But I just think, people have been doing things a certain way for so long. Humans, we're creatures of habit. And I just think it's just changing that mind shift that, yes, morally, it is the right thing to do. And I know some of you just think we're here as this fluffy exercise that wouldn't it be great if we were all, a diverse and inclusive industry. But actually, it's going to help your bottom line. And not only would it help your bottom line, if you're not going to do these things, it's you have a reputational risk on your hand because investors are voting with their feet. They are becoming a lot more demanding. You look at the AGM meetings, there's just a lot more going on in terms of activism now. Employees are activists in themselves now. So you've got, how LinkedIn and Twitter have grown so much now. So employees are, they're being more vocal. And all of these things can have a reputational issue or reputational impact on your company. So, you need to look at it from many angles. But there is a risk involved, but there's such great benefits involved if you do get on board. So, again, do look at it from all those different, perspectives. But I just think at the end of the day, there's all these great reports out there and McKinsey, they've done some. But, it just proves that having a diverse employee base, it's you're just going to perform better. Mm-hmm. So I'm still surprised that we have to justify or explain to people that it's a good thing.
On the practical points of promoting a diverse workplace and educational initiatives that firms can take, have you found anything that's particularly useful in terms of D&I training or perhaps not useful that a lot of firms are doing, which they could be doing better?
I think the one that I've heard that has done really well is when, external consultants come in and they kind of, they force, you look at the leadership team to do certain exercises and, sort of group discussions, etc. And it takes them out of their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. But actually they leave thinking they have learned, they have been educated. But I just think when you have a third party involved, they're a bit braver perhaps, and they can really ask those questions and really challenge. Mm-hmm. So that there are different types of things that have worked or not worked. But I think people are getting a little bit tired of unconscious bias ones, because that's been happening for a long time, but they're like, well, we need more now because it seems like everyone knows what that is. Mm-hmm. But how can we be more specific and go a little bit under the bonnet?
Also, what comes to mind for me then there as well is sort of passive training of mandatory PowerPoint or Zoom link, and here's a presentation, watch it for half an hour, then that's it for about the next 3 months. And what seems to work best is getting people involved, getting people talking, because that's really where the problems lie, because it's a problem of you can't articulate it. And if you can't articulate it, yeah, then you can't deal with it.
No, absolutely. Yes. I mean, I'm always a fan of face-to-face group exercises versus a very, a passive watch the screen and then over your lunch.
Possibly in the short term, we spoke about the commercial benefits of you know, having a more equal and diverse workplace. Do you think that there's momentum for investor pressure to improve representation, and there's actual pressure coming down on firms now from an economic standpoint to improve their diversity in their workplaces?
Absolutely. And Reboot is actually part of ShareAction's steering group. So this year, alongside ShareAction and other grassroots organisations, ShareAction started a campaign to say we want FTSE 100 companies, specifically let's start off with financial services, to disclose their ethnicity pay gap data. So we actually went to all the AGMs of those financial services firms. I went to the infamous Aviva one, and it was amazing. Like, most of them said yes, it's something they're passionate about, it's something that they want to do, so we'll go away and continue to have those conversations. And ShareAction, they're an activist group, and you know, they represent lots of investors, so they're kind of a collective coming together on behalf of these asset managers. So we're definitely going to see that. And you know, you look at it from an asset owner perspective, they're doing the same thing. So, you know, they are now asking those questions in terms of, you know, what as a firm are you doing to create a diverse workforce? What is your data? And if these companies come back with, oh, no, we can't collect that data for various reasons because it's actually not, you know, a regulatory requirement, think the asset owners are pushing back and saying, well, you need to find a way then. So yeah, there's going to be growing pressure coming that way from the investors. And you know, to me, I think that's a really positive step forward.
It's interesting to think about how important that is and will probably become in the kind of financial services realm that we, you know, that we write about and for, because there's a lot of consolidation and mergers and acquisitions happening in that space at the moment. And so, you know, presumably acquisitive businesses more and more are going to be looking at potential businesses that they want to buy and saying, you know, well, what kind of, you know, how much do these kinds of issues matter to you? And how much are you kind of truly invested in improving it, because it's really important for your business, you know? So I wonder if we'll see that become more and more of an important consideration in the kind of mergers and acquisition space as well, you know?
Yeah, and I would love to know if that will, because I think at the moment where we've been speaking, it's not been a huge consideration. So I think ESG broadly does get discussed, and I think E gets more attention, quite, you know, understandably, over the rest of it. So I think it's starting to happen, but I just don't think we're there yet. But I would love to see at what point they will, you know, like other industries have, you know, some are quicker than others, but they are all headed that way. So we're hoping that's what's going to happen there as well.
Yeah, it also speaks, I think, to the data point earlier, because you know, when in this industry, when firms want data about something from an investing standpoint, they get it.
So if
we have widespread sort of data on ethnicity and in terms of employees, I think then you can just get a bigger picture of, okay, this is working, this isn't working, what's happening here, what's not happening here. But it's a very interesting point about mergers and acquisitions, because of course, when you're acquiring a business, you look at all sides of it. But one of the things is, of course, employee practices and, you know, staff and workplace and, you know,
and retention and things like that.
Exactly. Are they good at keeping people? What are the practices like? So it'd be great to keep doing that, but also from an ethnicity point of view.
Or just broader diversity.
Yeah.
And yeah, and you know, and as per your point or everything we've been discussing, I think the more we're comfortable, the more people educate themselves and we move on from this very broad diversity or inclusion topic to understanding how, you know, the ramifications on all parts of the business, we can start asking those intelligent questions and we can start moving the needle a little bit more. And hopefully that's what's happening, unfortunately in increments, but we are seeing progress.
Do you think it's mainly driven by simply employing people at senior positions at the top, or do you think a lot of people are doing it without needing to? I'm just thinking about the pace of change here, because it's quite slow, but one of the reasons that some people might think it's quite slow is just because it's quite slow getting ethnic minorities into senior positions.
Yeah, and I think change can never be overnight. So, you know, and if you're going to make real sustainable change, it, you know, it has to happen at a certain pace. And, you know, and I get that. But I think we need to just remember diversity is one word, equity is another word, and inclusion is another. So whilst people or, you know, decision makers are very good at the diversity aspect, or they get that now, but they need to make sure that they're looking at it from an inclusion perspective, like, will this person feel like they fit in? And, you know, and the equity, are they getting the right resources just to ensure that they'll get to where they need to? You know, and inclusion for many at the moment is, you know, and I, you know, I did a separate blog a while ago where I spoke to 20 financial services professionals, but it, you know, they still felt like they had to conform to the culture. And they're like, you know, and a lot of them were like, but I don't go skiing, or, you know, I'm not into rugby, you know, so I just think, yeah, it's great that it's happening, but they are separate words, and you need to look at all of them just to make it right. Because like I said, that we're not going to be able to retain the talent. They will end up leaving. We know they're already looking at other, you know, other roles already, either within the industry or outside of the industry.
It also speaks to your earlier point about the term BAME, right? And why we stopped using it is because it was used to inadvertently, possibly, hide a lack of employees of, for example, from Bangladeshi descent or Asian descent, just because you'd get a lot of black employees, or vice versa. So I think these terms are always changing, and it's good that the terms are changing because they are useful for a time, right? But even I sometimes think when saying the word diversity, it's like, well, follow that up: diversity of thought, diversity of gender, diversity of race, right? So it's good that we're having these conversations, but I guess we need to keep talking and keep getting people talking to each other, because otherwise the terms get too stale.
Agree. And I think the thing I'm most excited about is, and again, not to give away my age, but you are seeing Gen Z coming into the workplace. So there's definitely been a shift in mindsets, and millennials are taking on those more senior roles. So I just think naturally that's going to drive a lot of change. But honestly, God bless Gen Z, because it's, you know, coming into the workplace, what they want, what they expect, you know, it's very different to what the millennials wanted versus, you know, the generation before. So I just think this is all going to help towards making sure these conversations keep happening, they keep evolving. So, you know, so again, I hope I haven't been doom and gloom, because I do think, you know, progress will be made, and there's loads of great driving forces at the moment. But we just have to, you know, groups like Reboot, amazing journalists like you, we just have to do our bit and keep the drumbeat going. You know, just to make sure we're making enough noise and that change will happen, and, you know, we put pressure on however we can.
So I just wondered about the pace of change there. I noticed that it was a bit slower in financial services compared to other industries, and I wondered whether that was just because of the age and the clients, just that point about Gen Z, whether the age, because the age of clients and advisors generally quite are older. I think it's about 50, the average advisor age. And I wondered whether you think age might be a factor there, or why you think that financial services seem to be a bit slower in catching up than everyone else.
Honestly, I don't have the exact answer, but it is a homogenous industry. So the demographic is quite concentrated. So, and, you know, and it's been like this for centuries and centuries. So, you know, you're not going to be able to break that in a day. So, I do feel like it's just really breaking that mold, you know, and it's the industry seen as quite elite, so to speak. And, you know, you look at those with those really senior roles, where did they go to school? What sort of an education did they have? You know, and obviously these are not my words, but it is a bit of, you know, that old boys club that comes to mind, etc. So it's really, you know, that's your starting point. So it's really having to break that down and really, you know, sort of bringing that fresh talent, or explain that, or, you know, to explain that why diversity is so important. Whereas industries, maybe it's not so, so solid in the sense that it's easier to break into. So I do think that kind of plays a factor within it. But also that lack of data, you know, until we start getting it. And it's great that the FCA is looking into, you know, the possibility of ethnicity pay gap reporting. But I just think once we have that data, you just can't hide away from it. And I think once we have that lay of the land, like, we can really, really do something with it and hold businesses to account. And, you know, and again, those investors and other stakeholders to continue to put that pressure on. And I think that's when you're really going to start noticing change, beyond increments.
Definitely. That seems like a great point to end on. Noreen, thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to The Advice Show with me, Zach Sharif, fellow NMA reporter Nicola Blackburn, and our guest from Reboot, Noreen Biddleshaw. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you at the next one.
Scottish Mortgage seeks out lateral thinkers like academics, authors, and experts in the industry to shape our investment ideas. Not the usual suspects and narrow mindset of financial analysts and investment industry commentators. That way, we continue to build a portfolio that reflects real-world progress, not financial world noise. Scottish Mortgage is managed by Baillie Gifford. A key information document is available by visiting baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk.